The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Case 23 from the Gateless Gate. Hui Nung's Neither Good Nor Evil. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Dayu Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bow, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practiced at Tuang Mei with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I am like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." The teacher said, "If you can say that, then let us both call Huan Mei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." So this is the first day of our Rohatsu Sesshin. This event commemorating the Buddha's great efforts and the Buddha's great realization. Our tradition of Zen comes to us through stories and teachings, comes to us from these forms we practice. This Zen tradition has been passed on to us from our teachers and from their teachers and from their teachers, going all the way back to this person we now know as the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the one who is awake. Buddha made very few claims for himself. He did not claim to be different, but he did speak of what he had experienced. He was, as the story goes, he was reluctant to do this at first after he sat for some long period of time. As the morning star, as Venus rose over the horizon, he saw clearly into the nature of life and death, the nature of this great matter. And as he did this, of course, his famous words translated in so many ways, but the one I like best is, "How wonderful, how wonderful. I and all the world are awakened together." He decided that there was no need to teach. It was clear. Life comes and life goes. The earth spins. Things come into being and things disappear. everything perfectly interrelated, what could be said about this? And so for a while he did not teach. But as he moved through the world, people were remarked at his presence, and it was clear that he knew something. He had tasted something of great value, some great treasure, and people wanted to know, wanted him to speak. So he relented and began his teaching career. For a time, he was quite a successful teacher, attracting hundreds and thousands and having patrons in the nobility who would loan them their woods to be in. Yet he lived a simple life. He did not build any temples. He did not start any great organizations. But he practiced and he talked about life. The Buddha never spoke in doctrinal terms. For him, and I hope for us, it was never a matter of belief. At one point he said, "A follower of mine does not take a position for or against anything." Not that we don't care, not that we don't help out, nudge the world toward kindness as we can. But yet this practice of Zen, not a matter of professing beliefs, but a way of living into our own experience. Again and again, the Buddha taught to pay attention, to look into this matter of life and death. And so from the Buddha's original teaching, many schools of Buddhism have arisen, and of course Zen is what arose in 6th and 7th century China. As the teachings of Buddhism that had been in China actually from the 2nd and 3rd century, as they mixed with the indigenous beliefs of Taoism and Confucianism, this wisdom in the Chinese culture, what came out was this a wondrous thing we now call Zen, Zen Buddhism. This is was at first quite a small and disreputable band of people, perhaps a little bit like us, set back from the road. Not many people knew anything was going on. But people who looked into this matter, not through just reading scriptures, and there were and are some amazing writings and words purported to be words of the Buddha. But this school of Zen was the meditation school. The mythical founder, Bodhidharma, who traveled some long distance to come to China, his main teaching, his main practice was wall gazing, sitting in front of the wall, eyes down, being here, being in this moment. And this is still, despite all of the other forms that we have inherited and that we continually create and recreate, wonderful, of course, to chant. Still haven't fully recovered from the pandemic and the years of not hearing other voices, the years of not being able to join in and here we are again, sitting in this Dharma hall, as so many have done before us, and Christine wonderfully leading us in these chants now so familiar to some of us. And we raise our voice, and we are included. We offer our voice, and our voice is received. And we together make this noise, chant these words, some of these words dating back to before the Common Era. Our sitting meditation coming back again and again, round after round, is what we rely on, is the core. This innate wisdom, we might say, this innate wisdom of being human, it's not that you know how to do this. Of course, you don't know, you can't know. I don't know, I can't know. But we can move toward, we can move in the direction. Move in the direction of life, move in the direction of presence, whatever we call it. And this story that I read, this 23rd case in the Gateless Gate, this story, quite a famous story, taken from the Platform Sutra. Platform Sutra was written in the latter part of the 8th century and is purported to be an eyewitness account of events that occurred 100 years before. It's quite unlikely, in fact impossible, that these events happened as they are spoken of, but yet this teaching, the Platform Sutra, one of the seminal works that has resonated now for so many centuries. Students like you and like me have read about this sixth ancestor, Hui Huang Mei, who received the transmission from the fifth ancestor. He was a poor illiterate son of a single mother, the story goes, and was carrying firewood when he heard someone say a portion of the Diamond Sutra, and had an immediate awoke himself to the nature of life. And he heard that there was a teacher, the fifth ancestor, Huang Mei, who taught this, and so he went up there, but he was not of the class to enter the monastery. He worked in the threshing room, threshing rice. And through a long set of circumstances, he submitted a poem, though he could not write. The teacher said this poem could only be written by someone of deep insight. And so the teacher met with him, this poor illiterate. I suppose wonderful to have some poor illiterate person become the hero. Gives hope for all of us, whatever we think about ourselves. In this transmission, it did not go to the one who was supposed to get it, the one who had the titles, but to someone else. And this idea that the wisdom of Zen, though contained in these stories, these wonderful koan stories and collections, and though these collections were circulated among the literati of the 11th and 12th century, they were dreaming of illiteracy. They were dreaming of a kind of naturalism from their cosmopolitan culture, dreaming of the woods. And I suppose we too, living our life in this 21st century, we too dream of some other time. Some other time when things were simpler or more pure or more direct. And in some ways, our practice of Zen is enacting our dream for these 3 days. All of us, as I love to say, have run away and joined the monastery. All of us have been willing to leave home. Not a small thing to do. The momentum of our lives is so fierce and sometimes seems to be getting faster and faster, but each one of us determined, each one of us decided it would be a good time to escape, a good time to leave the premises. And so each one of us left our life, our plants, our pets, our friends, partners, colleagues, whatever it was, to come, to join up together, to sit for these long hours, to hear these obscure stories. And a part of our coming is some kind of dream. Our human life, of course, is so much like a dream. All of us at one point were younger than we are today. Maybe you can see some pictures of yourself when you were 10 years younger or 20, or maybe when you were a girl or a boy, when you were a baby. All of us somehow miraculously know how to grow. As Melissa and I get to spend some time around young people these days with our grandchildren, every young person is so astonishing that they know how to grow. The mind knows how to begin to think. The legs know how to begin to walk. And they know how to do that without knowing how they know how to do it, right? I keep asking our four-year-old grandson when he's going to teach the baby how to talk. He doesn't have a good idea, but he thinks she's going to learn on her own, and she will. And you and I are Zen beginners trying to learn how to do this. How do we sit still? How do we breathe quietly? How do we bow when we are supposed to bow? How do we come back? How do we go on when our heart is broken? How do we meet our life? And this, these questions, there is no end to these questions, yet something calls us on, some taste, some insight, and we call these tastes, we call them awakening. This being human is shot through with awakening. Awakening is not something separate. In the story, Hui Neng refers to the secret teaching. Hui Neng has one of the big kensho's, sweat pouring down and in tears. He saw something. He thought he was coming for the robe and the bowl. The story goes that the most of the monks thought that the sixth ancestor was a usurper and had run off with the master's robe and bowl, these symbols of teaching authority. And they were determined to get these back. Of course, apparently they didn't listen to the teacher very much, or they thought the teacher didn't quite know what he was doing. I suppose that's a common occurrence. But they ran after, and apparently it was a large group, 50 or 60 monks took off after Hui Neng, and they chased and chased for weeks, and as the weeks went by through the woods up over the mountains, many of them began to give up. I guess I'll go back to the monastery and eat some of the Tenzo's yummy food again. A little rough out here on the trail. And after 2 months, all of them had given up and returned to the monastery, except this one poor fool, Monk Ming, the most foolish, most self-righteous, we might say, the most mistaken of all the monks. He was still at it. He still thought he was going to get something. And when he got to that place, when he got to the top of the peak, and Wei Neng laid down the robe and the bowl and said, "There should be no fighting over these. Take them." He could not. He thought, and for 2 months had devoted his life, "I am going to get it, I am going to get it, I am going to get it." Maybe you've done Zazen like this. "I am going to get it, I'm going to get something, I'm going to figure out what they're talking about, and I am going to get it." Of course, when we get close, or when we get exhausted, after we have given everything we have, after there is no other option, then something else can happen. Then there is room when we have totally failed, not failed a little bit, but when we have been unable to get what it is we think we want, then there is some opening. And he says, "I have not come for the robe and bowl. Please teach me. Please teach me." This moment is such a moment of ripeness, when we realize that what we thought we wanted, however we imagined awakening, however we imagined what it is we were going to get, we see is not the thing itself. And so Hui Neng says, thinking neither good nor evil, he says, when you give up your opinion about yourself, about how you're doing, who are you at this very moment? Who are you at this very moment? Not going somewhere else, not being someone else. With these words, Ming had a great awakening. One translation says he saw directly for himself. And that is what we are moving toward, this seeing directly into the nature of life and death. Which is not a matter of philosophy. Of course, Buddhist philosophy and Zen teachings can be quite lovely to read about and to think about. Taoism too, a wonderful system of thought. But what we're doing here is study and practice. What we are doing is truly going beyond these words, going beyond these stories, using words and stories as a way of going deeper and deeper into the heart of being human. And as we move toward this heart, toward this source world that is not somewhere else. We can see for ourselves. And as the monk says, now I know for myself, like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. These same words that Hakuin picked up many centuries later when he wrote the excerpt we read earlier this morning. Realization cannot be handed down and cannot be explained. Rather, it is like knowing for yourself by drinking it whether water is warm or cold. And he says, what joy is there in the realms of humans or gods that can compare with this, a glass of water, warm or cold, walking in single file around and around the temple? This is how we practice, and this is the realization. Huineng says this is not secret. The monk, when he wakes up, he says, after these secret teachings, are there any other secret teachings? Huineng says, this is not secret. There is no secret. Of course, our habit force is so strong. Momentum of our life, the confusion of our minds. It takes a long time, and it takes some great intention to settle down. This great intention and great determination expresses itself in all kinds of ways. We might say great determination expresses itself as the kindness to allow yourself to be here for these 3 days, for this sesshin. The kindness to take care of your life in this way, the kindness of not moving during a round of sitting. This great determination, sometimes we think it has to be a muscular effort, and what's required is more and more willpower. But willpower is not it. Maybe part of what's needed sometimes, but something more than that, touching something that is alive, something that is you, that is your life energy. We could call it bodhicitta, doesn't matter what we call it. But that longing, that dream, the dream of awakening, already here, past, future, here in this moment, all your whole life, a little baby till now, and your death, your passing away, your disappearing, a whole world appearing and disappearing, and somehow going and coming, we are never astray. So this is the great matter that we are looking into this weekend, using this wonderful story, this story of awakening, this story of determination, this story of meeting and being met. So case 23, Huineng. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Dayu Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, this robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you. Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bow, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practiced at Huang Mei with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I am like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." The teacher said, "If you can say that, then let us both call Huang Mei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." Thank you. So please sit comfortably, and servers, please come around in front of the altar. We'll have a little time to look into the matter together. So, our Dharma dialogue, who would like to raise their hand and share a question, observation, something about what we're doing here, what you're doing here? Yeah, Jamie.
Kami was at the end. A whole world comes and a whole world goes, you said. And it reminds me of something I've been thinking about a lot from the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment book about no exchange, that we don't, that it's a mistaken view to think that we come into a world of a cast of characters and we play our part and then we go, but somehow we're a whole world unto ourselves. Mm. And I wonder if you see any, like, how that connects to the koan.
Yeah, I think this idea that there is a world outside of us that we're separate from is the primary delusion, the fundamental delusion. There's me and the world. And you're referring to Uchiyama's book, and he's so clear that the self and the world create each other. And so each one of us lives in the world we live in, and everything we experience is part of our world. So from this sense, this idea of being separate, it doesn't mean anything. And I think this looking into, this waking up, what do we wake up to? The Buddha woke up to not being separate. We aren't lonely creatures wandering this barren land, but one with the bugs and the worms and the rice. All of it is part of us.
And I think another way of looking at this, which is very similar to what David's saying, but specifically about koans, and I think I would also say about dreams. So when, and this is a dream, you know, encountering other people. People come in to the kitchen and eat your food. A lot of this no exchange is happening because you can't exchange something that's already together. So in koan practice, you need to identify with all the characters. And so in this particular koan, we have two characters, and they're you, each one of them. There's a monk Ming, right, who's trying really, really, really hard to attain something, but they're chasing after the wrong thing. they think, the robe and the ball, I'm going to get it. And of course, that's not his experience by the end. And Huineng, too, he's running away because his teacher told him, people aren't going to accept you. So there's another part of that that we can resonate with, you know, who's the one who really, you know, from the outside looks like nothing. And then we believe that story about ourselves. And so he believed the story of Hungren, the fifth ancestor, go, get out of here. But then when he actually encountered somebody who was desperately searching but sort of going in the wrong direction, he was right there with him, right there with... I love that line, too, if you look for your original face, it's right there with you. It will always be right there with you. There's nowhere to go, there's nothing to do. And yet, if Ming hadn't chased him, Huineng wouldn't have blossomed into a teacher. So this complete interconnection between human beings is so important, and not to ever cut yourself off from anybody and think, I'm not like that person. Mm-hmm. You are that person.
And I appreciate you bringing up Jiama Rochi's book, because that view that we can step outside our life like as a stage to look at it, that's the dream. That's Ming was looking and saying, well, what other secrets are there, right? So he's imagining some other world that's beyond the world that he's in. And that's the Huineng points out to him that, no, it's this. Right here.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Jamie. Anne?
Yeah, maybe a similar question. On several of these koans, near the end, someone says to the teacher, now I understand, with your teaching, I now understand. And I go, what teaching? What did you just understand? And in some way, because the teaching seems so vague, it seems like, how could that make you understand? But then maybe I thought, well, maybe because he knew already in himself, and he just needed a slight push in the right direction.
You know, one of the reasons that Doksan is confidential is because again, this is so connected to what Jane was saying, the interaction between the teacher and the student is very intimate. And things that are said to one person will resonate, mm-hmm. and that are said to another person won't. You know, and here in this particular form, we're talking generally, mm-hmm. but also we're talking to the person who asked the question. We're doing both at the same time. And so in these stories, to try, again, it's the same teaching. What teaching? What just happened? And to look into that, if you were that person, what would you need to hear? And how did the teacher somehow give that person who's you, and you're the teacher too, just the right thing? You know, and really, what do you need to say to yourself? And sometimes it is very subtle, because people, we're ripe. This group is already very ripe, right? We've been sitting for a long time. Everybody in the room, there isn't anybody. If you think you're new, I'll show you a new student. There's nobody in here is new. So the ripening, and then just a little bloop. But for you, it wouldn't be the same bloop as it would be for somebody else.
Sarah.
Thank you for the talk. And it's sort of funny, Melissa, you talking about the book just was sort of helped congeal for me what was circulating. But I think what's most amazing and what I'm most grateful for about this practice are those moments where, you know, it's so interesting to hear these stories, because many of the koans that I've heard, and I haven't heard, you know, so many, but it is that there's another human, right? There's another human, maybe it's both, you're saying it's both of us, it's you're both people, but here's, you know, Sarah, and a teacher says to Sarah, you know, blah, 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 and then Sarah has an awakening. And yet, what's more sort of my experience is that I feel like I'm being fed, right, over and over and over and over, right? All these tastes of different things. And yet, I feel certain, right? That they are that, but they don't happen right then. It's later, and over the gratitude I have for, you know, there's still, I mean, probably because I don't taste it all the time. When I realize that thusness, and I'm in a moment, and I'm like, this is it, you know? Then there's this gratitude, like, man, why did I notice in this moment versus, you know, an hour ago, you know, when I was just blind and sleepy and dull, you know what I mean? And you can't know, I guess. And yet, so it's a delayed bloop. You know, that feels so special that I have all these ingredients inside of me, and then I don't know why, but sometimes up it comes.
The title of the book that Jamie is reading is called, well, another version of the title is called How to Cook Your Life. And this is what's happening. You're cooking. You're cooking over time. All of a sudden, whoop, the timer goes off. It's all done. Take care of the oven.
And going back to what Anne was saying, the reason this is because you already know.
Mm.
Right? Mm-hmm. And it's often clear, well, I don't know. He must be talking about those other people because, you know, look at me. So this impossible thing, so already know. And as we put ourselves in these situations to practice like this, it can find its own way. And the light on the floor or the taste of the food or the headache you have because you haven't drunk enough water or whatever, we can be touched by anything. You say, well, that's not it. That's just, you know, my headache. But as you say, Sarah, it shapeshifts and all of a sudden, and then I think for all of us, the gratitude arises to this universe, to each other. Yeah. Thanks. Matt.
Yeah, the second time thank you for the talk. The second time you read the koan, I was really struck with the chase. And I was thinking, you know, if he had caught up in 20 minutes, he probably would have grabbed it and, I'm good now, yeah. You know. But just this sense of him just completely depleting himself over 2 months, just wearing himself out. And what state was he in when suddenly Wei Meng turns around? It's like, you know, what does he know at that point? What does he want at that point? You know, I mean, I just had that. That's a big part of the story.
Well, and you know, there is Monk Ming was a general in the army before he retired and came to the monastery. He was strong. He was, you know, so for him, again, it was all so unique. He had to do that 2 months of running. And there is a funny thing about awakening, that everybody's path is exactly correct for them. And so some people have, you know, great effort, and oh, it's going to go, and I'm just going to bloop. And other people just grab the rope and bow and then go, oh, wait a minute, bloop. It doesn't, it's so we need to value our own struggles and not compare our struggles to other people, but then we have to have this radical empathy of who am I as Monk Ming? You know, what am I? Where am I wearing myself out? And then the other monks, you could also, there's other characters, right? All those other people dropping away, going, I don't know, this is ridiculous, I can't do this. That's also authentic. Everybody's doing the right thing. So I remember, I've been thinking about this, and when David was giving the talk, the thought kept popping up. Some people have these enormous, big, we call them Maha Kenshos, really everything drops away. And then they're faced with the rest of their lives having to integrate that, which is really hard, you know. And so you have the teacher then will be doing something very different from what the teacher might do for somebody who just has a little bloop, which is more of a continuous reminding. And, you know, as David said, we're already awake. We don't know it. So for some of us, it takes this big effort. Some of us, it doesn't take the big effort. But the integration is also slightly different for everyone, but it has to happen. You can't just have this wonderful experience and then be done. And you can't just have this little experience and think, oh, well, not for me, I'm done. There's no done. There's just continuous practice.
Just to add to, you know, I think for me that's part of the meaning of the immovability of the bowl and the rope. He had the bowl and the rope the whole time. Mm-hmm. It's Dharma. If you can't take it for yourself, because you already have it.
Brad.
Thank you for your talk. I smiled when you compared us to a band of renegades. I just wanted to ask and comment about emptiness, which I feel like I've known my whole life and don't know at all. And it seems like Shikantaza is really the maintenance of emptiness, I'd say, even though it seems like it's being in the moment and thinness, you know? It's about body and breath and being in the moment and being. At the same time, practice seems to be about maintaining emptiness, I don't know. So,
Brad, if I was a little closer, I'd come hit you with my stick. So interesting ideas, and I would sort of throw emptiness away, right? But you're talking about breathing in and breathing out. You're talking about a kind of immediacy that feels really important. And to call it emptiness and maintaining emptiness feels like just something you're going to have to lug around with you, right? The emptiness will take care of itself, and the emptiness is not separate from the form. It doesn't have to be maintained. But there is a presence I think you're pointing to. Almost as I hear you talk, I have this image of you with open hands, not grasping at all the things that come. Letting what comes come and letting it go. So no fixed position, we might say, not heading anywhere, and finding some stability in that nowhere. Just be careful of calling it names. Yeah.
And you know, in the koan tradition, again, where so much of our teaching comes from, when I was listening to all your ideas, there's somebody here to visit.
Just a male, I think.
Well, the door opened. Okay. Well, they left. let's see. Where was I? Oh, well, it doesn't matter. But the people in all these stories, many of them have really worked hard to create concepts. You know, and I was really with you as you were trying to explicate. You were making it general, but you were talking about yourself. This is what I've discovered. This is what I've seen. This is what and that's really an important stage in a way, to be able to own our theoretical understanding of Zen, and then see that it's not saving our life. It's in fact getting in the way, like David talking about it being something we're carrying around, and it's important. To you can't put it down until you've seen that that's not what nourishes you. You know, the famous Zen saying that you can't survive by eating menus. It's the thing itself all the time. So you have to stay with those thoughts, all the theories, until they wear away and you see that they're not useful. And then the only thing to do is to come to this body and this breath and this moment. But you can't say, I know, I'm going to come to the breath and the body in this moment, and then I'll... You can see how you keep making up these theories about what Zen is. Yeah. So thank you for demonstrating that.
Yeah. So maybe last one, Will.
Really just trying to process the same thing that both Sarah and Brad said. I think my particular spin on it is that when I get a little bit of some understanding, I try to turn around and think, so what was I not getting before? I want to sort of see the mistake, understand the mistake, because it's been really painful, right? And, you know, if I'm, I don't know, there's some, but it's, I can see that it's just another, like, needing to turn around and have something, have a theory about what was wrong. And, but that's my particular spin on it. It's less about, like, what is this, but, like, what was that before? You know?
Well, and one of the paradoxical things is these states that are so painful for us, we're so attached to them.
Yeah.
Because they're, you know, I may be an idiot, but boy, I sure am an idiot, right? And so part of what we're doing here is increasing our tolerance for joy and calm abiding. I can't take much of it myself, you know? But to,
wow.
To I guess again, like those open hands. So, and I think as Melissa was saying, we find our way by doing it wrong. That's the good news. So if you're doing it wrong, you're well on the way.
Right? Well, and the doing it wrong is such a funny thing. Again, in the koan stories, you hear this all the time. You know, that right and wrong are brought up. And, oh, I'm the one who does it wrong and all this stuff. And I love that you called out what Sarah was saying, too, because everybody who's spoken is coming from a place of trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
But the three of you, such different ways of figuring things out. How wonderful that is, that that we're so unique as human beings. And one of the things about Zen, which I'm still not thoroughly understanding after all this time, is how I talk about it a lot. Every single thing is the Buddha Dharma. It's not somewhere else. I think that's what the story is saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if I could tell you the story of my day today, so much crap has happened. A medication went wrong and all kinds of stuff. I mean, just one thing after the other. And all of that is not a mistake. It feels like it because it seems bad. It's painful. It's not what I want. And yet that is the Buddha Dharma showing up as a headache, a glucose monitor falling out. You know, the things that I don't want to have happen. I really don't. Driving here twice because I forgot stuff. You know, all this. And yet perfectly, so nothing, not in opposition to some idea of the way it should be. That's the key, really. How could this be what I've been searching for all my life? And that, you know, going back to Michael pointing out, not being able to lift up the robe and bowl from the rock. Perfect. This was a really strong guy. And the fact that he couldn't do it, you know, the opposition is what woke him up. And then, as Ian pointed out, he just needed a little bloop, little nudge, and then he fell over. Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, this life is so terrible and so full of pain and suffering, and it is the whole thing, no matter what we label it as. Even great, great pain and suffering is aliveness.
Well, so let's go on with our perfect day. So please restore the Zendo. And we'll sit for a few more breaths before our Jiki leads us in walking.